Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You'd have to read 100 books on an iPad instead of buying 100 brand new volumes to offset a single iPad's global warming impact. It takes 2,600 gallons of water to grow enough fiber for one organic cotton t-shirt. Assessing a product's environmental footprint is not so easy. My guests today are champions of eco-intelligence and better ways of helping consumers make informed decisions about what's really green. This hour, On Point, the ecological footprint of what we buy. And later this hour, we'll look at the big new court ruling on net neutrality and its impact on the future of the Internet. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Daniel Goleman. He's a science journalist and psychologist. His latest book is Ecological Intelligence: How Knowing the Hidden Impacts of What We Buy Can Change Everything. His op-ed in this last weekend's New York Times was, "How Green Is My iPad?" Daniel Goleman, thanks very much for joining us.
Tom, pleasure to be here.
And with us from Berkeley, California, is Dara O'Rourke, professor of environmental and labor policy at UC Berkeley. He's founder and CEO of GoodGuide.com, a website that rates over 65,000 products by their personal, social, and environmental impact. So far, the site covers food, personal care items, toys, and household chemicals, and has big plans to expand. Dara O'Rourke, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
It's great to have you both, and we're looking forward to questions from our listeners about products that they may buy or be thinking about buying. But just to get us started here, Daniel, I wonder if you'd take us through the interesting comparison you've just done between the total environmental impact of an iPad, 700,000 or so of them sold last weekend with its new introduction, and reading on a book or books. How did you do that complicated comparison, Daniel? What did
well,
you find?
I worked with Gregory Norris, who's a Harvard-based industrial ecologist, as is our other guest, Dara O'Rourke, who's out at Berkeley. This is a new field that has a methodology called life cycle assessment that unpacks through its entire life cycle the spectrum of environmental, health, and social impacts of all the stuff we buy. And it turns out there's nothing man-made that nature loves. Everything has impacts. However, there's what's called information asymmetry in the marketplace. When we go shopping, we haven't a clue about the backstory of the iPad versus the book, or, you know, the stainless steel water bottle versus those plastic ones. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think the bigger point is that we should have ecological transparency. Just as we have, you know, the price and we can assess the quality, we should know now that it's possible through this life cycle assessment methodology, what's the real environmental cost of what I'm going to buy and which is better. So let me run through the e-reader function of the iPad. We didn't do the whole iPad, mm-hmm. but this also applies to Kindles and other e-readers. Off the bat, the materials for the e-reader take 33 pounds of minerals to make that one, even a small little Kindle.
33 pounds of minerals for a product that weighs a pound and a half, I think I've read.
That's right. And not all of those are going into it by any means. Most of them actually are used in the plant, for example, in gravel pits to store toxic byproducts of manufacturing and so on. Or there are about a dozen rare minerals in electronics, many of which are mined in parts of Africa run by warlords or that use child labor. These are hidden human costs that we haven't a clue about when we go shopping. The book, on the other hand, comes out pretty virtuous when you look at the materials. It's 2 gallons of water for a book, 79 gallons for the e-reader, 33 pounds of minerals for the e-reader, 4+ for the book. When you move on to the actual manufacturer, it turns out that, again, the e-reader is hugely energy hungry and offputs lots of greenhouse gases, CO2, 100 kilowatt hours for the e-reader, 2 for the book, 66 pounds of carbon dioxide for the e-reader, 6.6 for the book. It's 100 times more.
What about the loss of the piece of a tree that goes into making that book?
There is the loss of the piece of the tree, and that does figure into the math. Mm-hmm. But the sum total, frankly, is that, as you said, you've got to read 100 books on that Kindle or iPad in order to justify the overall eco footprint of that electronic device.
And as you had many responders say, I think since then, you have to. That's buying 100 books. If you borrowed it at the library, it might be many thousands before it worked out the same.
Well, remember libraries. In fact, that's, from an ecological point of view, the virtuous way to go.
Dara O'Rourke, you've stepped in here not just on the iPad, but on tens of thousands of products to try and help people get toward that transparency that Daniel's talking about. How do you do that?
That's a great question. So we basically have been responding to this really rapidly growing demand in the marketplace that more and more consumers want to know about the types of impacts that Daniel just described. They want to know where their products came from. They want to know how they were produced. They want to know their impacts on their own health, their children's health, as well as the environment, workers, these other issues. So we started a project at UC Berkeley to pull together some of the science of life cycle assessment, industrial ecology, health impact assessment, supply chain research, and try to get that the best available science out to the public in an easily accessible form. And we really, just now in 2010, have finally, I think, the ability to pull together some of these emerging scientific fields like life cycle assessment with emerging information technologies, which we're deploying, ironically, on the iPhone, another Apple product. We have a tool that lets you scan a barcode. You can point your iPhone at a barcode and in under a second get a rating on the product you're looking at. And what we're trying to do is pull together right now about 1,000 different criteria going down the supply chain and life cycle of a product to help someone understand the full health impacts of that product, the full environmental impacts, and the full social impacts of that product.
Give us a sense of some of the criteria that go into that rating. Like
sure.
What?
So if we take a simple product like a bottle of shampoo, what you're looking at is first on the health side is what are the chemical ingredients in that shampoo and which of them are potentially human health hazards. So we take out all the ingredients and we evaluate them for human health toxicity. Are there carcinogens or mutagens or reproductive health hazards, endocrine disruptors, skin irritants, et cetera, et cetera. So the health assessment is really what's the impact on you as the user of the product.
Mm-hmm.
The second is the environmental impact. And life cycle assessment is this great methodology for evaluating the full impacts from raw material extraction to manufacturing to use to ultimately disposal of the product. So in, again, bottle of shampoo, it's a pretty simple product. It's a plastic bottle filled with a chemical formulation. So we evaluate what's the impact of making that plastic bottle? What's the impact of manufacturing the chemicals? What's the impact of you disposing of the product at the end of its life? And let's get a sense of the full environmental impact. And then on the social side, we're looking at impacts on workers, impacts on communities, whether they tested on animals, what their kind of overall corporate policies and practices are in treating their customers, their employees, their communities they work in. So we're trying to give a full view of the impacts. And for each product, it's a different set of impacts that matter. So shampoo, it's pretty clear. It's the chemical formulation that you're smearing on your head every morning. For the case of an iPad, it's really, as Dan points out, it's the metals and chemicals that go into it, the pre-manufacturing stage, and then the end-of-life disposal is the really big impact. Does Apple take it back, recycle it, get those toxics out of the environment so they don't end up causing more environmental or health harm?
Daniel Goleman, you've got a very big thesis that goes along with all this kind of work. I mean, you say in Ecological Intelligence, your book, radical transparency, that is, when we really know what goes into a product, holds the potential to better align what sells with the public good. It changes consumers from helpless cogs in a vast machine into a force that matters. You're picturing what millions of consumers who understand what's gone into a product then making socially, environmentally conscious decisions, and by that, changing what's made in the first place and how it's made.
Yeah, I think it's actually a very hopeful scenario because Good Guide, for example, is a proof of concept of the idea that you and me, when we go shopping, can have a single score. It scores things from 10, a virtuous end, to 1, summating all of those thousands of data points. And we can instantly compare. And Dara failed to mention, but I want to point out that one of the powerful features of Good Guide is not only do you get in 1 second a profile of that product, you can also compare it instantly to other products in its category. Mm. So this gives us a decision point we have never had before, which is easily accessible eco-comparisons of products that are valid, independent, and trustworthy, and that we can use to do three things. One is know the impact of what we're about to buy. Two, compare it to others and favor improvements. Mm. And three, tell everybody we know. Because if this goes viral, if it goes to scale, if it's not just us, but our, you know, all of our Facebook friends and who's on our Twitter feed and everyone we know, all of a sudden the fact that, you know, this children's sunscreen has that chemical that becomes a carcinogen when it's in the sun doesn't go unnoticed, but becomes a salient point that outrages thousands or tens of thousands of us. And we tell the manufacturer, and the manufacturer pays attention now, realizes we care and that market share is going to shift because of this. That creates a virtuous cycle. Economists say that markets work best when they're transparent, and that makes the business case for doing the right thing.
Call right here from Allison in Beverly, Massachusetts. Allison, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm so excited about this show because I have just been about this whole subject for a long time. First of all, with debating about whether or not to buy books on my iPhone or buy them in person or, you know, in text form, but also about the Good Guide, which I have as an app on my iPhone, and I love it. I think it's fantastic. The only problem is that as a mother with 2 kids, I think that is probably the primary demographic of people who are really into the Good Guide and things like that. Mm. I am very excited about using this information, but, you know, in shopping and when I'm at the grocery store with 2 children, it's hard to manage and juggle and, you know, load up the app and search the product that I'm looking
right,
at.
Right.
So it gets a little tricky. So I was wondering if they have any vision for getting a sort of, you know, speaking of transparency, a Good Guide visual guide in the stores with a, you know, stark rating system so you can see what you're looking at as you're shopping without having to load it up on the phone. So it's something more visible.
Yeah, it's a great question. Dara Rourke, there's your ideal user, and she's using you or wanting to, but juggling 2 kids plus the iPhone, getting to the app and everything else. What about putting a rating number right on the product? In what era, world, time, I don't know, political environment would that happen?
Yes, it's a great question, and it's exactly where we want to go with this. I think even with it on the iPhone, it still is an extra effort that consumers have to go through, and you have to pull it out and do the research. And started Good Guide, though, wanting to be fully independent and totally credible on our data and our ratings, and not to depend on a retailer or a manufacturer to grant us the permission to put it on their product or on their shelf. But we're seeing more and more consumers walking into grocery stores asking for this information, and I think there is now an interesting conversation with some of the largest retailers in the country to move towards transparency in the store and to move beyond just marketing, the labels and the market advertising and the big banners in the stores, to telling people what's really behind the label, what's in the product. And so that's something I would say in the next 2 to 3 years we'll see these types of information-based tools showing up on store shelves or on packages in the U.S. There are many companies that are going to be resistant to it, but I think some thoughtful leading firms will push this forward and try to get this information out to their customers.
Daniel Goleman, can you see that happening politically? I mean, first of all, is the life cycle assessment work that's being done today accurate enough? And even then, can you see the political demand to put this right on the product, maybe even require it, the way we've got the Surgeon General warning on cigarettes?
Well, the wonderful thing is that this is really a market-based mechanism. It doesn't require political action, which I think is wonderful because it means we don't have to, you know, have lobbies fight it out and buy politicians and all of that. It's you and me in force because it's our dollar that retailers and, you know, brand managers want. And if our dollar is going toward the more ecologically virtuous product, they're going to chase it. And in fact, there is now a sustainability consortium, with, as Dara mentioned, some of the biggest retailers in this country are members. They're already starting to ask suppliers for life cycle assessment information. They say within 5 years, we want to rate the products using this methodology and put that information next to the price tag.
Is Walmart doing that? Did I read it?
Actually, Walmart is one of them. Walmart made a big announcement that shook the business world, the world of commerce, because they said, we want to do this within 5 years. They're one of the members, founding mm-hmm. members of the consortium. We want this information from you, and if you don't give it, we may not carry you.
Let's go to Eastland.
It's a big stick.
Yes, it is. Let's go to Eastland, Texas, and Ron. Ron, you're on the air.
Hello. Just had a comment about you see hybrids, you see fuel cells, you know, all day long you're bombarded with the word green. And I often wonder if it, like, when it comes to, like, a fuel cell or a hydrogen fuel vehicle, you know, what did it take to create the hydrogen? What does it take to create the electricity that runs the electric car? That is never talked about. And if I hear the word green again in advertising, I think I'll throw up. I'm so sick of that.
I know exactly what you mean, Ron. It's so broad, and many manufacturers are very happy not to look too closely at it. But let's pick up hybrid cars, and maybe one day and going toward fuel cells and hydrogen. Dara O'Rourke, first to you. I mean, how do you look at the real cost, environmental, the whole gamut of that kind of transportation?
Well, it's a really great question. I think that one of the nice things about the science of life cycle assessment is it allows you to compare across the full impacts of different choices. So there are now on the market, I think, as Ron alluded to, a lot of green claims and, quite frankly, a lot of greenwashing, where companies are pointing out one minor green attribute of their product while ignoring the main environmental or health or social impact of their product.
Right.
And so we really have a problem in the marketplace of the proliferation of green claims, which often either omit the real impact or divert from the real impact or outright are false in their claims. So it's really critical that we get greater transparency into the full impact so that we can compare these choices side by side in a way that you really know whether you're advancing environmental or health or social performance or not.
What about hybrid cars? Have you looked at that sector?
We have done some early research on it. We're not currently rating cars on our site, and so we don't have ratings out on vehicles yet.
Daniel, what are your thoughts on that front? Because Ron raises a really good question. I mean, these are, you know, the miles per gallon is all over the place, but inputs and the battery and what happens at the end,
absolutely.
And never mind hydrogen fuel cells.
Well, if you do an LCA of a car, you have tens of thousands of discrete steps, each of which has multiple impacts. And the notorious ones, of course, are the metals that you need for those batteries, which are toxic. They're use resources mm-hmm. that can't be replenished. The story isn't a pretty one. And with hydrogen cars, you know, making hydrogen is itself a dirty technology. Or these all-electric cars, it's nice that you're not using gasoline, but wait a minute. You're plugging it in. And what about the coal-burning coal plant that's giving you the electricity to, you know, feed that battery? We need to step back and take this global perspective and kind of x-ray the inner workings of everything we own, everything we buy, cars, you know, tomato paste, shampoos.
Are you prepared to pass a judgment on hybrids versus, you know, mainline automobiles these days? All
well,
in, which is
we, you know, we need to rethink our categories. It's not binary. It's not this is green and that's not. As Dara points out, there is thousands of impacts, and we need to think, what do we care most about? From a fossil fuel point of view, the hybrid is probably a net plus. From mineral depletion point of view, from toxics along the supply chain, including disposal, they're probably net negatives. So the question is, what matters to us? And one of the things I love about GoodGuide is you can personalize your screen. It has, you know, 1,000 different data points, but you can say, well, what I really care about is toxics. I want to, defend my family against bringing poisonous substances into the house. And you can make that your primary weighting on looking at all products. You can say, I care about global warming. You can make that the primary. So I think we need to get more sophisticated in thinking about this and become active in voting with our dollars every time we shop.
Of course, that makes the outcome of that mass participation a little less unclear. It depends on what people really care about.
I actually think what will happen is a net benefit. Even if you're looking at global warming and I'm looking at chemicals, bottom line is companies now are noticing that market is shifting toward the ecologically superior product, which incentivizes them to do the R&D to come up with better alternatives. They just invented, you know, styrofoam, innocent styrofoam, never biodegrades. It's a petroleum-based product, and
our gift,
you know,
to
it's floating out in the ocean.
Right.
But some smart student at Rensselaer Polytech just came up with an alternative styrofoam. It's made out of rice hulls, which is a byproduct of growing rice, and mushroom roots. And it works just as well. And when you're done, you throw it, you put it in your garden.
Right.
And
plant something. That sounds great.
This is where we need to go.
Instead of chasing those styrofoam peanuts all over the yard.
Exactly.
Some devilishly difficult questions here, though. I've got one for you. Nashville, Tennessee. Deborah, you're on the air, Deborah.
Hi. Yes, my question is, looking at leather handbags versus PVC or fake leather handbags or similar products, kind of foregoing the animal rights aspect of the question, but just looking at the product itself, where does that stand?
So a handbag or something, that's a great question. Dara, I don't know if you've gone there, but leather versus fake leather, what, the ultimate, you know, environmental balance on it. How do you see it?
Yeah, so again, it all depends on how you do the leather. So there are versions of leather that are tanned through very intense chemical processes using chromium-based tanning chemicals that can be really highly polluting, very toxic for workers and the environment, but there are also much better ways of doing leather, and we see a transition in the leather industry also away from some of the toxic chemicals they've been using. PVC, I think, you know, really problematic, both from raw material extraction and a manufacturing and end-of-life disposal phase. So I would say net-net, good, well-managed leather manufacturing, taking aside if you don't have a moral issue related to the animal rights issue, that leather is going to be better overall for the environmental impact across the from the raw material extraction to the manufacturing to the disposal. PVC, we're seeing more and more a very problematic compound. Very long-living, problematic if it gets burned at the end of life, potential for creating dioxins, problematic at manufacturing for carcinogens and the exposure of the workers in those facilities. So I think complex story again, but net-net, leather is better.
We've got a web comment here, many, but here's one looking at some of the tough nuances in here. And this is Daniel Dar, this is from Keith, and he says, this is exactly the problem with modifying our environmental behavior, measuring the precise impact of different choices. For example, he writes, which is better, my wool pants that are natural but require constant dry cleaning, or my artificial polyester blend that goes in the regular wash? He says, we get so caught up in the minutiae that we can really mitigate our environmental impact at such small margins at best, and even there we can't be sure what are the real impacts of our choices. I mean, it seems to me, Daniel, he's saying, you know, you can get all in a twist about these fine differences, and still the big picture, I don't know, goes to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, I propose a different attitude, which is that every time you shop, you simply see if there's a better choice. And, you know, it might be tough if you've got two kids and you're using the iPhone app of GoodGuide, but you can take your shopping list before you go to the store in a quiet moment, go over it, look at alternatives, and decide then. I've done this myself. So instead of, obsessing about the fine details, I think instead we ought to realize that we hold power we're not using, and it's an enormous potential power for improving in the long term, the status and the impacts of everything made. And that power is the power of our dollar. So rather than think about, well, you know, if I dry clean it this many times, or maybe I should, you know, wash it and not dry clean it, or thinking about should it be polyester or wool, think about, well, which is the better suit when you go shopping? Which uses sweatshops, for example? Here's a dirty little secret about green products in apparel, and that is that, and this is where it does get tough. If you use organic cotton, those fibers are shorter than industrially grown cotton. Mm. And that means you have to grow more cotton per shirt. And cotton is grown in arid parts of the world. The Secretary General of the UN just visited Uzbekistan and declared the Aral Sea an environmental tragedy.
Desert, yeah.
And that was, they diverted the water for cotton plantations. So there's one part of the equation when it comes to textiles. But then on the other hand, it is good not to use pesticides and not to use chemical fertilizers because they're toxins and they kill water.
Of course.
In some. And then there's the other story, which Dara alluded to, which is that the dyes used in textiles have lots of carcinogens in them. Workers in dye houses have leukemia. So
let me put this to you. Here's another kind of skeptic. This is from Facebook. And everything you're saying kind of presumes that consumers, people, will use this power for good. It presumes a kind of faith in human virtue. Mark says, the human footprint is presently massive, sprawling, polluting, and highly destructive. He says, yet the human race is presently extremely ignorant, proud, and stubborn. I think poking at the assumption that if people know this stuff, they'll necessarily use it, that they'll necessarily go in the direction that a rating, Dara, might suggest.
Well, let me speak to that.
Let's go to Dara first,
sure,
if I may,
go ahead.
In California.
Sure.
Okay. So we have now not theoretical evidence on this, but empirical evidence that people in the U.S., mainstream consumers in the U.S., want this type of information, and they actually will use it. And even in cases where I think your skeptic from Facebook might lean towards, even for what you might think of as selfish reasons, they're using it to protect themselves and their kids and their health. They want safe, healthy products, first of all. And that's every American. Every consumer wants safe and healthy products. No one wants shampoo with carcinogens in it. No one wants toys for their kids with lead all over the toy that's going to expose their kid. No one wants a toxic electronic in their household that's going to cause them health and long-term problems. So we see there's a real, very strong, growing demand for safer, healthier products and for greater transparency into those issues. Then there is, I think, a broader spectrum of issues that a long tail of communities in the U.S. care about related to climate change or biodiversity or animal rights or different issues. But around the core principles that are very much market-based, as Daniel alluded to, well-functioning markets should have full transparency. People should know what they're buying. They should be able to make decisions about what they want and what they don't want in their house, what they put in, on, and around themselves and their families. They should have the right to choose, having full information about that. So we start with that. Not that we're trying to push people towards a certain lifestyle, a certain decision. As Daniel said, we allow in goodguide.com to fully personalize. You can pick and create what essentially could be a selfish screen to just pick products that are only safe and healthy for you and not care about the rest of the world. Or you can consider other broader issues. So we see real evidence, millions of people wanting this information and using it to make actual decisions in the marketplace.
I should say you can find links to green apps and resources at our website, onpointradio.org. And we've got a lot of comments there as well. Ellen says, on e-books, can't be recycled through the League of Women Voters, whether to libraries in Africa or to high schools. Once you're done with an e-book, can you send it to your nephew? Well, maybe, but not if it's kaput. A lot, well, I suppose, will end up in landfills or maybe better spots than that. Let's go to Wendy in Newton, Massachusetts. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I need some help trying to do the right thing.
Okay.
I work in an after-school program in Brookline, and we've been struggling with what kind of cup to use to serve snack to the children because
okay.
we go through about 100 cups a day.
Wow.
So we switched. We thought we were being so wonderful, and we switched to a 100% corn-based cup that is fully biodegradable and compostable.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, we found out two problems. One is maybe using corn to make things like that is not really the best environmental use of land, especially where people are starving in the world. And secondly, at this point, the city of Brookline does not have a municipal compost.
Right.
And these kind of cups, we originally thought, well, those of us with our little backyard compost heaps would take them home, you know, and compost them in our backyards. Well, apparently you can't do that with this kind of product. It has to go to an industrial composting situation because they...
So may we take that one up on your behalf, Wendy? May we look at that one?
Yeah, I'd love it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your call. Daniel, first two, paper cups versus that corn-based compostable. You hear Wendy's dilemma at the after school.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I'm actually going to pass it over to Dara.
Dara, what do you say?
Yeah, so again, a really important transition in the marketplace. So more and more consumers were demanding recyclable or biodegradable cups. Industry responded with these corn-based plastics, polylactic acid and other corn-based plastics, and it turned out the first generation of these were, back to the kind of the hybrid question, some of them were basically greenwashed. They either weren't really biodegradable or compostable in a realistic time frame, in a realistic way, or they were coming from industrial agriculture that was pretty questionable. Genetically modified corn, often for the growing of the corn, lots of petrochemicals in the growing, and then you'd end up with something that was potentially recyclable or compostable.
So what should Wendy do at her after school? How would she justify one decision or the other?
Well, so there are. She does have an institutional problem that the city doesn't pick this up, and so that's one thing.
And compost it,
And this is one thing that a point I want to make. I think both for Daniel and I, the point is not just individual consumption and people buying their way to sustainability or buying their way out of trouble. These are things that we do have power over as individuals, but we also need government. We need institutional decisions where we need the infrastructure to be able to shift to a more sustainable economy.
Point taken, so, and that's a bigger conversation. But she's standing there in the market. She's got... You know, a lot of cups being used every single day. What do you advise her today in her circumstance?
Well, in a situation here in Berkeley, we can get more sustainable corn-based plastics that are biodegradable and that are manufactured in a sustainable way. There's actually a company that was founded in Boston that is doing basically sustainable natural plant-based plastics. And so there are alternatives to the big industrial corn types. If she can't compost, but she does have a good recycling program, then I think going to 100% post-consumer recycled paper cups is the right way to go in her setting.
But I take your point.
The
whole context really matters here. But this makes that clearer in a way that's interesting and probably helpful. Let's get one more call. Idaho Falls, Idaho. Juliet, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a professor in the field of agriculture, and I have some comments about... Well, number one, as a consumer, I totally applaud the effort. I do have some concerns about the increasing costs associated with labeling, potentially, as we increase the costs associated with labeling and then decrease the actual returns to our American growers. And secondly, I'd like to ask about the definitions of sustainability and who determines what is more appropriate. In my opinion, genetically modified organisms and traditional American agriculture in a lot of cases can be much more green than the organic field of production. And I was just wondering if that could be commented on.
Cost and how do you define sustainability? Daniel, how do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, let's talk about cost. Right now, we're in a kind of a donut hole when it comes to cost for better ecological alternatives because they haven't gone to scale. Typically, there's small startups that are more expensive. As this becomes more demanded in the marketplace and there's more demand, then costs will go down. For example, as the big retailers start to ask their suppliers or demand of their suppliers that they give us more ecologically virtuous products, those suppliers will find ways to keep the costs down. So I think the costs will lower for genuinely green products. As the market demand, that is you and me going shopping, increases.
And then there's the politics of deciding what's sustainable. Juliet's an ag professor, and she's just fine with genetically modified agricultural products. Others may not be. I mean, you can have some real arm wrestling here if you start raiding along these vectors.
Right. Dara?
Yeah, so that's where we really are trying to empower individual consumers to find the products that match their own values and concerns. So that's one where if Juliet feels strongly about it, she can, in our system, actually find products that either are or are not containing genetically modified organisms. And I personally am agnostic on that issue. I want to let her find the products that match her values. To her earlier question, I mean, labeling, I think, is something that increasingly will be a cost of business, of being transparent to your customers about where your products come from, how they're made, what's in them, and what the potential impacts are. The real cost in most of the products we buy every day are in marketing and in the advertising and in the packaging, and it's not the real cost of the production. As she knows from the American agricultural system, the farmers get a very, very small slice of the overall dollar that you're spending in the store. That's where I think, again, really important that we empower people to find the kind of food they want, local or organic or whatever their issue is, helping them find the products they want that match their own values is really where I think the market's going.
It's an exciting prospect. You can see endless subtle complications. I mean, these days our minds are on these coal miners in West Virginia, the Big Branch mine. You know, we've got decisions to make coal versus nuclear in this country, and those would no doubt factor in. I mean, Daniel, have you thought about at that scale? I mean, how do you make those decisions? There's a human cost right in front of us of one. There's a long-term cost of the other, nuclear. How do you look at it?
Well, of course, it's all trade-offs, but I actually don't favor looking at issues like that in terms of the choices we have today. I really think we want to use the marketplace to make it pay to innovate. For example, there was a reactor design that was considered in the 70s using thorium rather than uranium, which has a much better safety record. In fact, it's probably zero hazard and much more easy to store post-product, which are the two big issues with uranium, you know, with the reactors.
Right.
But, you know, that decision, it was Admiral Rickover who decided to go with uranium because he wanted it for his subs. You know, we need to revisit the limited range of options we have and think of how we can reinvent everything. Because, frankly, every system we have today, every manufacturing platform, every chemical was developed in a day when we didn't have a methodology like life cycle assessment to look at the ecological impacts. Mm-hmm. Now that we do, we need to rethink and reinvent everything. I think it's an enormous entrepreneurial opportunity.
Well, watch this space. Daniel Goleman wrote Emotional Intelligence, the book, back in 1995, now 5 million copies in print, and it's part of our everyday vocabulary. Now his book is Ecological Intelligence, and you've really opened our eyes to more of the nuances there today. Daniel Goleman joining us from Amherst, Massachusetts. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. A pleasure.
And Dara O'Rourke at UC Berkeley, founder and CEO of GoodGuide.com. Check it out. Dara O'Rourke, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
In a moment, an appeals court strikes a sharp blow against the FCC and net neutrality. This is On Point. Yesterday, a Washington, D.C. appeals court ruled that broadband providers do not have to give equal internet access to everyone. The cable company Comcast argued that a service called BitTorrent, which allowed users to exchange large, often pirated video, should not be allowed to slow down everyone's internet service. The FCC argued against discriminating against BitTorrent. The court sided with Comcast, throwing into question the FCC's ability to regulate the internet and keep it equally open to all. Joining me now from New York is Eric Esseldahl, senior technology reporter for Businessweek magazine. Eric, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
We're good. So what's the new day that has apparently dawned on us with this court decision? What will it mean for internet content providers? What will it mean for consumers? And, of course, some people are both.
Well, immediately for consumers, I don't really see anything changing. And I think Comcast even issued a statement to that effect. This was really an argument over the statutory authority of the Federal Communications Commission, which, of course, has been in business since the 1930s, over whether or not it had the regulatory power, the statutory legal authority to regulate the internet. And one of the things that it had done was try to tell, it sanctioned Comcast for restricting the use of BitTorrent by its customers, and in an attempt to kind of shape traffic and prevent, say, a small number of people from affecting the traffic that a larger number of people could get.
NPR's example this morning was if one person goes in and downloads the Bible or some a great big book, in effect that slows things down for everybody else. But once you give a company the power to decide to discriminate, they could discriminate in all kinds of ways.
Right, right. The basic question here is, what is a bit? Well, can you treat one bit differently than another? Say, for example, telephone. A lot of us get our cable TV and our internet from the cable companies, but a lot of us also get our phone service from the same cable company.
Right.
Now, what if you choose to use Skype as your calling service instead of the cable company's preferred calling service? Could that cable company then discriminate against bits that happen to be used by you for Skype and maybe make them get in line and wait while the customers of their calling service are making their calls? And right now, the court decision yesterday basically said that, in theory, Comcast and the other broadband service providers can do that because there's no statutory authority from the FCC saying that they can't.
But doesn't that call into question the whole internet as we've known it? I mean, the idea that everybody can go in, offer whatever they will, it gets carried. I mean, does this mean that Comcast is going to be picking winners in terms of what services or media offerings are advantaged on the internet? That would change everything, wouldn't it?
That's indeed the worry. But what's interesting is that there doesn't seem to be any big changes right now. And what's kind of important here is that the FCC, this is a policy question that goes very much hand in hand with the FCC's hope to bring broadband universally across the country. The FCC launched its national broadband plan last month, wants to bring 100 megabits to 100 million homes by the year 2020, I think it is, and also to expand broadband access in rural areas. I've been in some of these rural areas that don't have access to broadband. Comes to mind Hickman County, Tennessee, where I spent some time a couple summers ago.
So how does net neutrality figure into that effort?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the FCC was figuring that it could, once it was able to get the statutory authority to regulate the Internet, then it could start making changes to something called the Universal Service Fund. The Universal Service Fund is what's used to pay for universal access to telephone service in rural areas. The FCC, part of the FCC's broadband plan was to create a new version of the Universal Service Fund to cover the costs of expanding broadband into rural areas. And so with that authority, the FCC would be able to do that. Without that authority, it kind of casts the major technology policy initiative of the White House and the FCC into question.
I'm missing how the net neutrality question comes to bear on the money that would have come in from the telephone.
Right. What it has to do with literally is whether the FCC has the authority to regulate the Internet. The FCC would then have the regulatory authority to say, okay, we're going to make some changes to the Universal Service Fund using this statutory authority, and then move it over to the broadband. And so at the moment right now, the FCC doesn't have any legal authority to regulate the Internet, pretty much, period, except as what Congress says it's ancillary to carry out its already predefined mission.
Well, let's say if Comcast, is putting its own content on the web, could it now, with this ruling, discriminate against competing content on the web, make its arrive faster, sooner, quicker, and everybody else's go like molasses?
That is the worry. But, of course, Comcast and all the service providers would argue that these are their networks. They're the ones who have invested the capital and taken the risk and moved forward with attracting customers, and they're the ones who have to operate their networks at a profit. So one extreme example that was put up by Wired today was saying, for instance, let's say Comcast or Verizon or whomever decides to do a deal with Microsoft and Bing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you type in Google.com, and who's to stop any of these service providers from taking your request to go to Google and instead pointing you to Bing? It's an unlikely example, but it's not completely impossible.
Does, on the other hand, yes, it's their network, I guess, but this is a utility, and we've had laws and regulations on utility forever. Is there talk about new legislation that would answer the court decision with a new writ for the FCC that would permit them to reinstate net neutrality?
It comes down to how you choose to define internet service. And right now, under the Bush administration, there was a bunch of rules and decisions that came down that basically said that it's going to be unregulated. It's not going. It's an information service, not a telecommunication service. And so there is a so-called nuclear option that could make the internet turned into a telecommunication service, and that would give the FCC legal authority. But then that would arguably discourage carriers from investing. And their argument is that we've had, you know, the iPad was just launched the other day. We've had, you know, numerous wonderful devices that run on the internet. All this great internet innovation over the last decade. Why mess with what's broken? You know, why, if it's not broke, why fix it?
Well, we're clearly talking about the information future here and its shape. Really interesting. We will continue to follow this issue. Eric Hesseldahl, senior technology reporter with Business Week magazine. Eric, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.